Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Today we're talking restaurants. For all the foodies in San Francisco, you know that San Francisco is one of the world's fine dining capitals. And certainly if you look at the Michelin Guide, San Francisco's doing quite well. Michelin awarded 7 local eateries those coveted 3 stars this year. But as many servers, dishwashers, and hosts can certainly tell you, the area is no stranger to the uglier sides of the food industry. For example, sexual harassment plagues this industry nationwide. Local culinary celebrities have been accused of assault, along with others around the country. And according to one study, the Bay Area food service workers of color face the biggest disparities in pay in the entire country. Many restaurant owners and workers are trying to address these problems, and here today to share with us how the industry is pushing itself toward creating better workplaces, we're joined in studio by Gwyneth Borden. Gwyneth is the executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. It's a nonprofit trade association that represents the culinary industry in the San Francisco area. Gwyneth, thanks for being here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And we're also talking today with Saru Jayaraman. She is the co-founder and president of the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. That's a group that advocates for restaurant workers across the country. Saru also directs the UC Berkeley Food Labor Research Center, and she's joining us from Berkeley. Saru, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thanks so much. 11 million people in the United States work in the restaurant industry, and according to the U.S. Labor Department, it is among the fastest growing sectors in the country, and yet 7 of the 10 lowest paid occupations in the country are in the restaurant industry. Gwyneth, let's start with you. There are probably a lot of people who are not surprised by those statistics. Lots of folks work in restaurants. No one expects that they are particularly high paid. However, in looking at this issue for today, I was surprised. Some people who work in restaurants do quite well. So the maitre d' who greets you might be making in excess of $100,000, even $200,000, where in that same restaurant, in the back of the house, there are people working below the poverty level. So just talk about the industry in general and how common that disparity might be.
Yes, the disparity is quite large because of the factor of tipping. As you know, the difference between the maitre d' and the person in the back of the house historically has been that they can't share in tips that customers leave. Many customers don't have any idea about this, and we're really excited. I know Rock, Saru, and I congratulate her and others who worked on the changes in Congress and with the omnibus bill to allow tip sharing in the non-tip credit states. But it's a huge challenge. It's a challenge for retention of workers. It's a challenge for people making ends meet. It's a challenge for people showing up to work. And so it's something that the industry is very, it struggles with, because the challenge on the other end, and not talking about fine dining, but when you talk about other kinds of restaurants, you know, people have an expectation of inexpensive, cheap food. Unfortunately, because of, you know, the mass production of and factory farming that people became accustomed to in this country, you know, people perceive food to be something they don't have to pay a lot of money for. And so the fact that there's not an elasticity of the consumer dollar in their perception of how much a cup of soup should cost or a bowl of soup should cost and all those sort of things makes it a bit challenging to raise your prices to a way that you can pay people at a better level. I think the issue of tip sharing helps quite a bit with that, because, you know, the maitre d' is not working harder to make $200,000 while the person in the back of the house is working extremely hard and under a lot of pressure for the entire segment of a dining experience. So I think it's something that we've been really working on as an industry, and how we can do that, how we can better train people, give them better skills, professionalize the industry, create greater mobility so people can move up the ranks and not just, you know, if they're a prep cook, can they become, you know, a sous chef, and can they become an executive chef? So all of those things are something that the industry is really grappling with, because it does have high turnover and high absenteeism.
We're going to talk a bit more about tip sharing and some of the other changes that are being made as we go along. Saru, I'm wondering, in your experience professionally, do diners seem to even care about these issues when they come in for a fine dining or fast food experience, for that matter? Do you find in your research as you look into this matter, do diners factor this in their decision-making at all?
So, as you may know, we've been not only doing research, but actually engaging consumers for the last 16 years around the country on these issues, engaging about 30,000 workers, 500 restaurant owners, and 23,000 consumers around the country. And so, no, at first blush, without kind of information or engagement, consumers don't engage with these issues. But we've had many decades of experience now figuring out how to both educate, reach, and engage consumers on these issues. And we find that when people actually learn these things, when they know these things, when they're engaged around these issues, that people do care quite a lot about how people are treated in the restaurant industry. And just to add a little bit to what you asked earlier about pay, you know, I think it's very important to note that the inequities that we're talking about that Gwyneth mentioned, which are very real, are primarily in the fine dining segment of the industry. We've got three segments in our industry. We call them limited service or quick serve, anything without full waiter service. We've got casual restaurants, and there are quite a number of them. And then there's fine dining, which is one segment of three in the industry. And in fine dining, we do see a tremendous inequity between not just front and back, but even within the front of the house, meaning the dining staff, between servers and bussers and runners, between in the back of the house, between the chefs and the dishwashers. We see tremendous inequity. But we also see inequity across the segments in that, you know, people of color, immigrants, women, formerly incarcerated folks are all hired in this industry in large numbers. This industry hires lots of people, gives lots of opportunities. It's really great in that way to lots of different people. But women, immigrants, people of color, formerly incarcerated folks do end up getting stuck in lower level segments of the industry and lower level positions in fine dining. So servers in casual restaurants don't make a lot of money the way you talked about maitre d's and servers in fine dining restaurants making. And none of that is the way it has to be. It's not, no pun intended, organic to the nature of running a restaurant to pay people very little. And that's proven by the fact that there are fabulous restaurant owners in the Bay Area and all around the country, and we can name several of them, that really work to provide livable, even thrivable wages for everybody in the restaurant, whether they're casual or limited service or fine dining. And that's something that consumers can engage around. Consumers can encourage restaurants to take what we call the high road to profitability, providing higher wages and better benefits and better mobility. And we've done that through something called Diners United, which is a consumer association we created several years ago, where we're engaging consumers around the Bay Area and around the country in actually interacting with employers and saying, I love the food here. I love the service. I would love to see you be a part of an association that's promoting what we call the high road to profitability, which ultimately is better for workers. It's better even for employers, less turnover, as Gwyneth mentioned. And it's better for diners to have a better dining experience when workers are able to thrive and stay over long periods of time.
Gwyneth Borden, you have been tracking statistics of your own, I'm sure, in the restaurant industry over years. But recent statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics really were shocking to me, that workers of color earn 56% less than white males. Women of color earn about 71% of white male income for about a $4 an hour wage difference. To me, that was pretty shocking. Is that something that you have found to be consistent across the board?
I mean, I think the problem is in our country, we have institutionalized racism and implicit bias. And I know that this is something that we've tried to work with Rock around, helping our restaurants look at. There's a real challenge because people's, you know, biases influence their decision making. And while we're truly trying to work to get people to hire the best people for the job and to promote people and give people training, I think the challenge is a lot of people haven't dealt with their own personal issues in terms of hiring people. There is also, I think, especially when you get to fine dining, and one of the reasons that we've supported culinary boot camps and the work that Rock's doing, there is kind of a gap, especially if you're talking about fine dining. If you grew up in a household that didn't dine out, you haven't had experience with white tablecloth restaurants, you weren't educated about wine. I mean, why would you be, right? That wasn't your life experience. You're shut out of those kinds of positions because most restaurants don't have the ability to provide training, or they don't take the time to provide the training to people to give them greater mobility. So there's a historic institutional challenge that we as an industry and as a country are dealing with. And then there is a actual kind of sometimes skills related challenge. And then in a very fast paced kind of environment, people don't always make the strong effort to give people mobility opportunities.
Saru, you know, as a consumer, as a restaurant, I love all of the Bay Area dining opportunities. And you want to be ethical, but how much of a burden do you place on consumers to try to be ethical? You know, you don't want to drink wine that is made from non-union grape harvesters. You don't want to eat veal. You want to be vegan so that you're protecting animals. To what extent does this extend that responsibility of the consumer to be ethical in their choices of eateries?
So the first thing is to be informed. We've done at this point, as I mentioned, several years of research on this issue of racial segregation in the Bay Area. And unfortunately, the Bay Area has the highest race wage gap between white workers and workers of color of any region in the United States. Now, I mention that when you say, what is the responsibility of consumers? Well, as the Bay Area, we pride ourselves in being progressive, on having better wages and working conditions than other regions. But unfortunately, we have the worst record on racial segregation in the restaurant industry. And so that does mean that we all bear responsibility because, frankly, we can do better as the Bay Area. And so what is that responsibility? First, it's to understand what's happening. So what is happening? All of our research shows that, as I mentioned, segregation, that racial wage gap, happens because of segregation on the basis of segment, as I mentioned, workers of color and women and immigrants being pushed into lower level segments of the industry, like casual and fast food restaurants, and then lower level positions like bussers, runners, and back of house kitchen positions, as opposed to getting server and bartender positions in fine dining restaurants. In fact, we've done what's called match pairs audit testing, where we've sent 400 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants. And we found that white applicants have twice the chance of a person of color of getting a fine dining server position, even when the person of color has a better resume. And this happens because of multiple reasons. As Gwyneth mentioned, we look at it in terms of the three stakeholders. In terms of workers, there's a self-selection bias. Workers feel very uncomfortable to apply to fine dining restaurants when they see nobody that looks like them either working there or eating there, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so we need to provide training and confidence building, which is what we do at Rock. We provide a lot of training to workers to help them move into fine dining service and bartending. We need to work with employers to help them overcome both this kind of idea that there are no applicants, so provide them with the applicants that they need through the training programs. But also, as Gwyneth mentioned, they're implicit bias. So we've been doing implicit bias training and testing with employers to help them kind of understand that this is something unconscious. This is something that, as an industry, is systemic. It's not based on individual actors. And so we all need to be a part of encouraging employers to change. And so that comes back to, okay, well, then what is the role of the consumer? Once you understand these things, once you know that this segregation exists, and unfortunately that the restaurant industry in the Bay Area is the worst on these issues, but it could be the best. And why do I say it could be the best? I mean, as the Bay Area, we are the birthplace of local and organic cuisine. And that really happened. That whole movement around local and organic happened because of consumer demand. Consumers asking restaurants, is this local? Is this organic? What's in my meal? Is this vegetarian? And restaurants actually responding to that demand. And so we have created very simple tools for consumers to be able to similarly push restaurants around issues of pay and mobility, particularly for workers of color and women. And gender and race equity that results in things like racial segregation and sexual harassment. And so we have a guide called the ROC National Diners Guide. It's an app that provides consumers with information on which restaurants are moving in the right direction. But we didn't create it to tell you which restaurants to eat at and which not to, because we want you to support all workers and all restaurants. No, instead we created the app as a tool for you to be able to communicate with employers. Again, I love the food. I love the service. I would love to see you work on desegregating your fine dining service staff. I would love to see more diversity among your servers and bartenders. And the tool provides the ability for you to communicate those values to the employer via the app or in person, you know, through actually talking to the employer in the same way you might have asked in the past, is this local, is this organic? I would really love to see you provide local produce, organic produce, or biodynamic wine in that same way. You can communicate with employers through the tools we've created. Again, I would love to see you create more diversity among your front of house staff. That's important to me.
And Gwyneth, I imagine that would put pressure on some restaurants to take action in terms of diversity in their hiring. And why not create a list of ethical eateries?
I think it's great. I mean, we were ocean-friendly restaurants, Eat Real restaurants. We're very big supporters of any sort of guide that allows consumers transparency into practices of restaurants that they would like to support. So I think that's a great idea. I would say that, by and large, I mean, restaurants, the hiring struggles that not only exist here but nationally, but specifically here because of cost of living, have really forced restaurateurs to really look at how they can find more diverse workforce and people who are here that need jobs, because, you know, you're not going to hire someone from somewhere else to live in San Francisco and work in a restaurant. So I do think people are really open. I mean, the time is ripe in the sense that if people are there to be found, you know, restaurants will hire them.
And it is hard when you can't afford to live close to where you might be working, whether you're waiting tables or as the maitre d'. It's challenging in the Bay Area, yes?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the biggest challenge, of course, is the cost of living, and then the cost of transportation as well. We don't have a very robust late-night transportation network. BART closes very early for workers who might live in the East Bay or the Outer East Bay. They don't want to work a closing shift at a restaurant in the city specifically, even though their wages could be higher in doing so, because the transportation cost is so high, or the opportunity to get home might take them an hour or 2 hours after a very long shift.
One of the other issues that have come up recently as regards working in restaurants is the issue of sexual harassment. And in the 2018 Golden Globes red carpet, we saw actresses who invited women from a variety of industries, including the restaurant industry, and they wanted them to share the spotlight and raise awareness of sexual assault in restaurants. Saru, you were at the Golden Globes, and you were with comedian Amy Poehler. How did the spotlight sharing perhaps change the conversation a bit around sexual harassment in the restaurant industry? And has that attention begun to fade?
No, it's been an extraordinary year for this work. You know, we've been doing research for many, many years that shows that there's a direct correlation between forcing a mostly female workforce, because most tipped workers in the U.S. and in California are women, forcing a mostly female workforce to have to depend mostly or entirely on tip income really is the source of the fact that, unfortunately, our industry has the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the United States. Now, some people hear that and feel immediately defensive. You know, our industry is a beautiful industry. And I think bottom line, we can all agree that people in our industry should be treated as the professionals that they are hospitality professionals providing an incredibly valuable, important, critical, life-sustaining service to all of us, which is feeding us. And so they should be treated as the professionals that they are. And that means allowing them to work in an environment free of harassment. And the research is pretty undeniable, not just from our many years of research and tens of thousands of surveys and government data analysis, but from other academics, even at Cornell School of Hospitality Management, which is widely regarded as one of the top hospitality management schools in the country, that unfortunately, you know, heavy dependence on tipping is what really creates an environment in which you've got a mostly female workforce having to tolerate all kinds of inappropriate customer behavior in order to feed their families in tips. And the variability of tips also gives managers and even coworkers a lot of power over women who must, in the front of the house and the dining staff, rely on the variability of tips, which is entirely reliant on pleasing people to feed their families. So that connection between low wages, high dependence on tips, really is the source of, in all of our research, of incredibly high rates of harassment. And our research shows that the higher the wage and the less dependence on tips, the less sexual harassment you're going to see. And fundamentally, that is about power. It's about the power that consumers have over servers. It's the power that managers have over servers. It's the power that anybody in the restaurant has over, again, a mostly female workforce that is forced a lot of times to depend in large part on tips to feed their families. So has the conversation changed? Absolutely. We've been so astounded at not just the level of attention that the research has received and the level of the way in which workers' voices have been elevated in the Bay Area and all over the country, women saying enough is enough, time's up, but also the beautiful ways in which we're seeing a really redemptive moment for many restaurant owners who are coming to us and saying, we actually want change. We want to figure out with you how to change this industry. And so we're now working with some restaurant companies that were very intransigent in the past. We're working actually with one or two chains that have approached us and said, you know, we actually want to talk and think about how to change. And so a lot of the things that we've been fighting for a very long time, higher wages, less dependence on tips, you know, professionalizing this industry, are actually now gaining just an incredible amount of momentum. And whether the press continues to cover it or not really doesn't matter, because this moment has opened up an incredible conversation in the industry and change in the industry that will, I think, be transformative regardless of how long this particular press moment lasts.
Well, I know I tended to associate charges of harassment with managers and chefs and owners. And as Saru said, people with power, those tend to get a lot of attention, the high-profile celebrity chefs who've been accused. But as Saru said, sometimes that harassment very often comes from customers. And there's a restaurant in Oakland, it's called Homeroom, and it's apparently owned and run by a former labor and employment attorney. And that restaurant has established a color-coded system to deal with harassment from customers. Yellow if the behavior is concerning, orange if the manager should maybe step in, and red if you just need to kick that customer out. And it gives the waiter the power to determine how to deal with a customer that may be out of hand. Gwyneth, how common or uncommon is this whole phenomenon?
Of harassment by customers, obviously that is a challenge that happens pervasively. What's really interesting is, to your question, the industry is very much, you know, coming together around how can we take a leadership stance and change the toxic environment of restaurants. And I think, you know, to talk about, you know, the tipping, that's important, but I think that you have to look at it as an industry that is, it's ironic, because you look at the origins of restaurants and they're male-dominated chef restaurants is kind of the perception. I was looking at an old newsletter from the 1940s from my association where they felt the need to differentiate between the male restaurant chef and the female home chef. And I think that's kind of the crux of sort of where things have started. For a very long time, the restaurant industry has been very much gravitas, bravado. I mean, even before women were in the kitchens, they were harassing environments, just a different sort of harassing environment. You know, a lot of yelling and like explicitives and people, you know, being not the best culture. And so, you know, the conversation we've been having as an industry overall is not, I mean, sexual harassment, of course, being front and center, but in general is how can we change the culture of a restaurant, which is a grueling environment and can be very toxic because of the number of hours, the fact that you have, you know, customers and alcohol and inhibitions are lower. It's in the leisure hospitality space. So it's an issue that's kind of about kind of the origins of the way that the restaurant industry morphed in the first place. We next week at our industry conference are actually having a panel on sexual harassment. Erin from Homeroom is talking about her customer system. We have the Perennial and others who've actually developed a posting that's going to be distributed by Cherry Bomb and Mother Jones for restaurants to put in the back room for their employees on how they can report harassment and join the Me Too movement. And we're really, as an industry, looking at how can we take a leadership place in changing the culture of restaurants, not just as it pertains to sexual harassment, but in terms of expecting the rights of individuals, of everyone in the restaurant, making everyone have a voice in the restaurant, everyone have opportunity in the restaurant. That is kind of the larger issue that we're really starting to hone in on. Sexual harassment actually really just shined a light on, you know, some systemic cultural challenges that the industry really faces, and that it must really stand up to change that. And so next week, we're really challenging our colleagues and bringing people together to talk about how do we take the next step? We actually have a couple people on the panel who've been through some high-profile sexual harassment accusations related to business partners or businesses that they're involved in, talking about the lessons they learned and how we need to chart a path forward.
That will be April 9th and 10th, the Golden Gate Restaurant Association's annual industry conference. Should be interesting. I would have loved to have gotten a look at that 1940s manual. I bet a lot of our eyes would have rolled back in our heads if we'd gotten a chance to see how far things have come.
No, I to that point, there was a survey that they had done that, you know, that people, that customers can prefer waitresses with shorter skirts and bigger boobs, or something really ridiculous like that. It's like that. Unfortunately, so that's, I mean, we're talking about
that hasn't changed. Unfortunately,
wow.
I mean, all the data. I was mentioning an academic from Cornell School of Hospitality Management that has done a lot of research on tipping that shows that tipping actually is not correlated with service on the, you know, on the aggregate. It is not correlated with quality service at all. It is correlated with your gender. Men get tipped more than women. It is correlated as a woman with whether you touch the customer. It's correlated, unfortunately, with breast size, hair color, eye color. As a man, you get more tips if you're taller and if you don't touch the customer. So, you know, unfortunately, what Gwyneth's talking about hasn't changed that much. And that's why it's important to, as we think about industry culture, think about one of these core elements of our industry culture, which is something that no other industry has, which is such a heavy reliance on tips, and also this kind of customer is king mentality. That reliance on tips and the customer is king kind of culture really, unfortunately, creates a power dynamic in which every man in the restaurant, the customers, even the kitchen workers, the chef, the managers, all have power over women serving in the front, relying on having to please the customers. Because all of the men know that they have to help the woman please the customer in order to get those tips.
That's Saru Jayaraman of the Restaurant Worker Advocacy Group, Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. And also joining us today is Gwyneth Borden of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to take your calls right after this. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter and find out what's coming up next. We love it when you have show ideas for us, so drop us a line at yourcallradio@kalw.org. We're hoping you'll give us a call today at 866-798-8255. Tomorrow, by the way, tune in for the weekly Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be discussing Middle East coverage this week. But today, we're talking restaurants, the restaurant culture. Do you work in a restaurant? What's been your experience? As a diner, do you make choices about where to eat based on what you've heard about how staff are treated? And would you be guided by a list of ethical eateries as to where to eat? 866-798-8255. 5 is the number. And Saru Jayaraman is here. Sorry, Saru. Saru Jayaraman. Okay. Yeah. And Gwyneth
Jayaraman.
Gordon. Jayaraman. It's right here in front of me, and it's pronounced just the way it's spelled. Thanks, Saru. And Gwyneth Borden of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. So we hope you'll join us. You know, there's an email from an interesting point of view. It's a restaurant owner who says, my husband owns a cafe in Hayes Valley in San Francisco. Because he buys high-quality foods, such as organics and such, and pays high taxes and fair wages to his staff, even though the cafe is busy, he's barely able to make payroll and is constantly behind on the rent. My husband, my son, and I live in a one-bedroom, rent-controlled apartment, and we qualify for Medi-Cal. Gwyneth, can you talk a bit about the challenges of being a restaurant owner, particularly in a place like the Bay Area?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really tough here is we have a variety of things that make it very costly. Obviously, real estate's very, very costly here. I think I saw one of the accounting firms that represents over 100 different restaurants locally said that rent was up 13%. So we have very high rent. We have very high cost of living. So even if you're paying above minimum wage, which is also, you know, high, vis-a-vis, say, a cafe of your certain size or stature somewhere else, you know, it's really tough because you can't charge in a cafe environment, especially too much to customers, because customers do, they're price sensitive, right? Unfortunately, while people spend a lot of time thinking about the cost of like whether or not food is organic or those sort of factors, they seem less concerned about whether or not people are well paid and whether or not they should pay more as a consequence of it. And so I think, you know, there's a perception that restaurants make money hand over fist. It's very, very difficult to do that. There is a lot of competition. Food prices and other things are high. You can't outsource your supply chain to another country. That's not possible. We have very high salary and wages because we are very progressive, and we have health care and paid sick leave and paid parental leave. Those are all wonderful things, but they also do drive up the core cost of labor, and the big expense any restaurant has is in the labor segment. A lot of the smaller restaurants, I mean, they're barely making ends meet. I mean, it actually was very fascinating. We have among our membership segment, a large portion of our members make less than $750,000 a year. And I don't know what amount they make, but that's usually a family restaurant, you know, maybe a couple and maybe other family members or a couple other employees. But a lot of restaurants, the majority of restaurants, not the ones that the national publications or local publications cover every single day, but most restaurants are not making money hand over fist. People are very much at the margins. And that's what people need to understand, is that it's not, even if a place is busy, it doesn't mean it's making money. Restaurant margins are very thin, on average 4-6% nationally. And it is very true that, you know, for a lot of restaurants, that teetering balance of trying to maintain both the cost of food and the cost of labor makes it very difficult.
Do you know how long the average restaurant lasts in the Bay Area?
You know, it's hard to get a number on that. The health department doesn't really track that data. Whenever someone has a change of ownership, which can sometimes be a partner transferring ownership, it triggers a new health permit. So it's hard to really track that information, to be honest. I mean, most turnover, again, is not, I think what's really hard is they say on average a lot of new restaurants close within the first year. We don't seem to see that. We see that people last a little longer here. I guess it really depends on your upfront investment. If you've built out a $1 million restaurant, you know, you can't survive as long as somebody who spent, you know, $10,000 to fix their space to go into. So a lot of it has to do with the upfront investment and how intensive that is. A lot of places can survive for a super long time if they didn't make a lot of upfront investment, maybe just have their family working there, and, you know, and keep it very bare bones.
So there's really no average. Spans the spectrum. You know, I'm also interested in finding out about large corporate chains and venture capitalist financing and how competition is created when you've got these mega investors investing and perhaps competing against individuals who are just raising capital from friends and family.
Yeah, it's very hard to raise. And what's really fascinating right now with the boom in the industry, what we've really seen locally is that a lot of the boom is as a result of people from the tech industry, whether it's venture capital individuals or people who've made money in tech investing in restaurants. Mm-hmm. I mean, there aren't really venture capital firms that invest in, say, independent restaurants. Those firms, there are firms that get involved with, you know, big chains, people doing like the Impossible Foods, Impossible Burger, or people doing sort of innovative concepts. But if you are a individual restaurateur trying to chart a path out for a new concept, you're more likely source our friends and families and other people that you can get to invest in your business because you don't have any collateral. You don't have anything for a bank to put there. Of course, that does, you know, going back to that inequity, you know, a lot of men, young chefs are much more easily able to seek capital because of their network and because of the people that they know or because of who their customers might be in getting their restaurant started. So that is something that one of the challenges we see big time is how can we get more access for women and people of color to those opportunities for major capital, because it comes by very easily for men, particularly white men, but not so easily for those other segments.
Okay, let's take a call. We've got Joy in San Francisco. Hi, Joy.
Hi, this is a very interesting discussion, Renee. Thank you for having your guest on. I work at a really established San Francisco restaurant for 25 years, obviously I'm a female, but I don't know how to insert this issue here. Not only are restaurant servers and front of house dependent on tips, they're also dependent on favorable social media reviews, such as Yelp or Facebook or that kind of thing. And when we were talking earlier about perceptions of service, that can make or break a restaurant. If there's service staff that aren't doing, for example, what the customer wants, the customer can get on one of these sites and kind of bash the restaurant. So I just wanted to maybe ask your guest what their opinion about social media's impact on restaurants.
Saru Jayaraman. Thanks, Joy. Thank you a lot, Joy. Saru Jayaraman, how has Yelp changed how restaurants behave and the changes that they're willing to make based on consumer feedback?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that definitely Yelp and these, you know, consumer websites have definitely made the industry more responsive to consumer feedback, but I definitely think Joy's point is incredibly important that, you know, consumers often have perhaps too much power and not enough information about what's actually happening in a restaurant in order to make these kinds of comments or reviews. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, in the same way that tipping is really a reflection of some of the worst biases in our country, in our society, in that same way, customer reviews can be based on the same biases, not liking a particular server, maybe not because the server's not a good server, but because of some bias you have or some particular kind of mood you're in. I mean, the idea that a person's income, livelihood, ability to feed their children is dependent on the whims and you know, kind of caprices of how you feel that day as a customer and how you react to a certain person serving you is really, really problematic. On the other hand, I think consumers who are conscious and can get educated on these issues and engage on these issues could also, in the same way, have power to move restaurants in the right direction, to provide better wages and working conditions, greater equity and mobility, and actually less power to consumers. So consumers could actually demand that a restaurant create a policy like Aaron's policy at Homeroom that says, you know, workers should be able to signal if there's a problem with the customer. So consumers actually have the power to push the industry in the right direction in the same way that right now there are problematic things happening in the ways in which consumers affect workers and restaurants. And that is really something that Yelp and other platforms like that should think about, because right now, if you put a comment about labor issues, working conditions, wages, mobility, or diversity of the staff, or sexual harassment, for that matter, on Yelp or one of these sites, they will take it down within a number of hours. And that is not something we agree with. We think if you're able to rate a restaurant on its food and service, you should be also able to say, I'd love to see this restaurant pay better. Or I noticed there aren't very many women on the dining floor. Or I noticed that there aren't very many people of color on the dining floor. Those kinds of comments should be, you know, if we're going to make comments, you know, universally accessible to consumers, then those kinds of comments should be accessible as well. I think the major point here is that we need to, as I've mentioned, educate and engage consumers on these issues to encourage more employers to move in the right direction. And I just want to make a comment on the previous conversation you and Gwyneth were having about employers struggling. We definitely agree that for a lot of employers, it's a tough industry. But as workers and consumers push the industry to move in a more equitable direction and in a direction of really seeing the workers as the professionals that they are, I think we can support employers in making that move. And so consumers being able to not only tell restaurants, I don't like this, I don't like that, I'd love to see you do this, but also demonstrating support for employers that move to higher wages, that diversify, that do the right thing is incredibly important so that people who do the right thing feel that support, feel like, yes, I can do this, feel like I can make it past the hurdles of low profit margins and high rent and all of these things. So we've created a training and technical assistance program for employers to help them move with very intensive support, to help them move to greater equity and to higher wages and to less, less dependence on consumer tips and consumer feedback, similar to Aaron's model. We've worked with some fabulous restaurant owners in the Bay Area. Daniel Patterson is really a leader on these issues that we worked with for quite a while to desegregate his restaurants and make them more diverse. So we've been creating these supports for employers and at the same time creating the guide for consumers so that as consumers, you can not just leave these negative reviews that Joy is talking about. You can actually go support restaurants that are doing the right thing and help them, show them that, you know, we will put our dollars and our support behind restaurants that make these bold and courageous moves.
I want to invite listeners, if you work in a restaurant, if you own a restaurant, if you are a regular diner, should there be a list of ethical eateries? How do you feel about your power as a consumer to offer feedback to these eateries? 866-798-8255 is the number, or your call at kalw.org to drop us a line. Gwyneth, we talked a bit before we started about the Chronicle Top 100 list. So talk about that list and how being on that list impacts people's decisions about where they should go.
Absolutely. I think there was a study that found that 30% of diners were influenced by the Chronicle Top 100 list. And there was an article on Sunday in the Sunday Chronicle where four different food writers opined about whether or not restaurants who had been accused of harassment should be included in the Top 100 list. And I think what was really fascinating is that most notably the chief critic, Michael Bauer, said, well, you know, I don't evaluate other things other than the food and the customer experience, and the customer doesn't experience the sexual harassment, so it's not really mine to judge. And so in some ways, while he said that he was putting these restaurants at the bottom of his pile, he actually said, well, you know, maybe not, right? And I think that's not acceptable. I mean, the point that Paolo Lucchese so eloquently made is that there's so many other great restaurants. Why do we have to lift up the bad people? I mean, I think the challenge we have in general, particularly in the world of food media, is that all the attention is placed on a certain segment or group of restaurants that have the ability to, you know, wax the PR machine and get the word out. And I'm not saying that those restaurants aren't great and are not deserving of accolades, but they're not the only ones. And that's the point that Paolo makes, that there are so many other restaurants, and why aren't we lifting up people who are doing the right thing? There's great food among them. We're just not looking for them. It's the whole issue of that they don't even get reviewed to be on the list. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, we do have to look at as a culture, and I think, you know, what Paolo as a writer says, it's like his responsibility. Journalism lifts up these places. They make them the places that everyone goes to and everyone refers to. And they have an obligation and a responsibility to not lift up those that they know aren't treating their workers well, right? I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, us as an industry leader, we want all of our members and the people that are involved with us to treat their workers well. We want to provide the tools so they can do that. We want them to be the best possible restaurant. We want them to have the best possible food and the best possible service, but we also want them to have the best possible work environment. So there is a responsibility, I think, for the consumers and the reviewers and the food media and others to look at these issues more closely. And until we can kind of make those large scale changes in looking at those things, we will continue to see that. Because what one of the other points that was made is that because these restaurants are high profile and are very well respected, people endure horrible working conditions because they feel like if I work for this place, you know, I've made it. When I go somewhere else, I can get a better opportunity or I can open my own restaurant. I mean, people do it. Those reputations are partially why they have the permission to behave badly.
And yet, it turns out that some restaurateurs that behave well do get recognized. There was a report recently, and it was circulated pretty widely. One restaurant in particular, Alta CA on Market Street in San Francisco, made really significant changes to their staffing. They decided to start having front and back house staff swap their jobs on some shifts. The idea was to tie the pay to the person and not the job. And I'm wondering how other restaurant owners have responded to that. What tools do the restaurant owners actually need if they want to create a more egalitarian workplace?
Well, one of the things that we've done here in San Francisco are these culinary boot camps, and we got money from the city for these and worked with the success centers. Or these are centers where people who are coming out of the housing projects, maybe they were formerly incarcerated, and providing front of house training, right? Because the whole notion is that, as Saru mentioned, the better paid jobs are in the front of the house, but a lot of people maybe were not exposed to fine dining restaurants or full service restaurants growing up. So it's a 2-week intensive training to help people have the basic skills for front of the house work. And it's through programs and things like that that we can really start to move the needle. Obviously, Rock and Saru have developed a much more expansive training program, and we're looking to work with them and others to expand that training. But part of it really is providing the knowledge, finding the people that we know need jobs and skills improvement, even within your own restaurant, and helping them get the skills that they need. You know, it's really hard for a restaurant themselves, like Kala in San Francisco. They have chosen to hire 50% of their workers as formerly incarcerated individuals. But that obviously has a toll on their restaurant, that they're a training restaurant as well as a full-scale restaurant. So looking at how we can take programs like that and put it in an environment that allows more restaurants to participate in that, and also to really grow the skills without the expense of kind of maybe burdening one particular restaurant.
Yeah, Alta made that change based on that was the Daniel Patterson restaurant that I mentioned that we helped. We worked with Daniel over a 6 to 9 month period to go from 11% people of color to closer to 60% people of color in his fine dining staff. And so we worked with him and his team over a very long period of time to make that change, and out of that created something called a racial equity toolkit, actually a toolkit to help other employers also make the same move. We did actually the same exact process with Homeroom, and that's what I was talking about. We provide free training and support for restaurants who want to make these changes. We also provide, as Gwyneth mentioned, a lot of worker training. So we've been providing worker training in terms of fine dining service and bartending to low-wage workers of color and women and immigrants, formerly incarcerated folks, for many years, to hundreds of workers. And now we're actually, in partnership with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, opening up a new center in Oakland, in the Fruitvale, called Restore Oakland. We've bought a building that will house Colors Restaurant, our training restaurant, and restorative justice activities to help individuals in the industry who have had interactions with the criminal justice system get out of the criminal justice system. And so through these programs, we're going to be able, at the restaurant, we're going to be able to actually train thousands of low-wage workers of color to move into fine dining service. We're going to be able to work with lots of employers who want to actually make those changes. And like Gwyneth said, identify people in their own staff who want to move up. We'll be able to help more restaurants like Alta and Homeroom make these changes. So it's really great. And on top of that, all of that, one thing we haven't discussed at all this hour is this huge, huge win we just had in Congress that will help a lot of these employers with issues of equity, which is that after a really long period of fighting President Trump's proposal to make tips the property of owners rather than workers, we finally won. We won bipartisan support for a rider on the congressional omnibus budget bill that just passed a few weeks ago that President Trump signed. And the rider says that tips are absolutely the property of workers. And we at ROC really led that fight to make sure tips are the property of workers. But it also said that when an employer pays the full minimum wage, as is required in California, that tips can be shared with the back of the house. And that allows an employer to create some amount of greater equity. It allows for the, you know, incentives or disincentives of tipping to be spread. It just creates a lot more ability to kind of create equity in the restaurant, and for a restaurant owner to also kind of deal with some of the imbalance that they find between front and back. So there are a lot of new supports that we're, you know, fighting for and able to provide employers with, that Gwyneth provides, that we're going to see come online with Restore Oakland opening up next year as a new restaurant training facility for both training for both workers and employers. And we hope consumers across the board in the Bay Area will get engaged, look at our diner's guide, and really push more restaurants to do what Alta and Homeroom did.
Got time to squeeze in maybe just a couple of emails. Joey in San Francisco says the cost of doing business here is so high, people don't think about fees and accessibility when they're deciding how much they're willing to pay. And Rose in San Francisco says, I worked for about 25 years as a server in restaurants in San Francisco. I never in all that time experienced sexual harassment, not from customers, not from management, and not from coworkers. And management always made employees feel that they should immediately report any harassment. Maybe I was just lucky. People seem to tip 15% to 20% because they know that that's the etiquette. So that's what some of our listeners had to say about today's conversation. It has been really enlightening to hear what's happening kind of behind the curtain. When you go out to eat, hopefully folks will feel a lot more informed now that they've heard from the two of you. I want to say thank you so much to Gwyneth Borden of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association. And of course, Saru Jayaraman, thank you so much for being here from the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. Thank you both so much. I don't think I'll go out ever and look at my meal quite the same in a restaurant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We hope you'll listen to some of our past shows. Sign up for our podcast. Visit yourcallradio.org. And thank you again for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.